I think I was so excited last hour in introducing Gary Matsumoto that I neglected to mention that promo that I said I was going to explain. So pardon me for that, leaving you hanging, if any of you even noticed. But coming up a week from tonight on Coast to Coast, I'm going to have two experts on who will each have a little help on either side, but two experts on the subject of 9/11 from their distinct perspectives. You know, there's been a lot of discussion about the 9/11 conspiracy theories and the people that call themselves 9/11 truthers, people that are out there for what they say is to expose the inconsistencies in the official story of what happened on 9/11. And so coming up next week, we're going to pretty much dedicate the whole show to exploring just that. An expert on the 9/11 truth position and an expert on the 9/11 official story. They have been in this conversation before, yet they have very strong differences about how information and data can be interpreted. And you'll hear that coming up next Saturday night on Coast to Coast with Ian Punnett. And coming up next, then, we'll continue this discussion about vaccine A, how it affected so many soldiers, an unstable vaccine, perhaps a vaccine that could be creating an autoimmune reaction because of what went into it, and how this will be affecting all of us very possibly in the future on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Well-known reporter Gary Matsumoto writing the book Vaccine A. We're talking about how it very likely killed and or permanently disabled thousands of GIs and how it may be affecting us in the future. A rushed vaccine before the Persian Gulf War that explains so much. And one of those things that we talked about was that it was a vaccine that was sort of thickened with something called squalene, which is something that's in our bodies. But our bodies, when it is injected into our bodies as a foreign object in order to stimulate our immune system, in order for our immune system to recognize, oh, we must stop this from coming back into us or affecting us in the future, therefore creating the immunity to anthrax, it also, in a sense, was creating an immunity to ourselves. We were attacking our own squalene that was in the system. Now, do we really, I mean, what's the closest we can come up with, Gary Matsumoto, for a figure of the number of Americans that were that had Gulf War syndrome after the first Persian Gulf War?
We've got more than 250,000 troops who have reported some sort of illness stemming from their service in the Persian Gulf. Now, I don't think all of those complaints could be attributed to an experimental vaccine. It's just a very, very kind of mushy thing to do to try to come up with the numbers, because the military has not done what many people would consider to be a sound epidemiological study. So we don't know. I can tell you what we do know, and that is, you talk about autoimmune disease, and it's probably a term that not a lot of people hear, even though it's fairly common. What most people will know are the diseases themselves. The most common ones being multiple sclerosis, lupus, and rheumatoid arthritis. Now, a lot of the troops coming home for the Persian Gulf were at first told they had some sort of problem with stress from combat. And then they were told that they had depression. And then some were told, well, it's just your imagination. And when they went eventually to civilian physicians for an examination, they were clinically diagnosed with one of these autoimmune diseases like multiple sclerosis and lupus. And what was particularly peculiar about this is that diseases like lupus normally afflict women at a rate of 10 to 1 over men, 9 to 1 or 10 to 1 over men. And most of the lupus sufferers coming back from the war were men. So something was really askew here. And then the military did later on admit that there was a statistically significant amount of ALS in Persian Gulf veterans.
Lou Gehrig's disease.
Lou Gehrig's disease. And the military, I think we have to point out here, has never admitted that it is administered any experimental medicines or vaccines to troops. They vehemently deny this. But there is a little bit more than pure circumstantial evidence indicating that this did in fact happen, which is, as we've discussed earlier, a perfectly legal thing to do under the current regulations. In 1998, the FDA, the National Institutes of Health, and the Department of Defense organized a special working group to accelerate the development of the new vaccine that was first devised at Fort Detrick, interestingly, by Dr. Bruce Ivins, who was later accused of being the anthrax letter mailer. It was developed in 1989. By 1998, the military was ready to deploy this vaccine, and it contained squalene. Now, what happened was when this program got underway, the vaccine was being administered to troops who were mainly deploying into the Persian Gulf area. We were running a northern watch and a northern no-fly zone and a southern no-fly zone over Iraq. So a lot of Air Force personnel were flying over there, if not flying as fighter pilots, as support troops for the squadrons deploying over there. And they got the vaccine. And many of them started to complain that they were getting very ill. And as it happened, a lot of them were developing the same autoimmune diseases that Gulf War veterans developed when they returned from Saudi Arabia. And we're talking about lupus, we're talking about multiple sclerosis, and we're talking about rheumatoid arthritis. Now, what I did in a report that I wrote for Vanity Fair was I tracked the complaints to specific lot numbers of anthrax vaccine produced by a company called Bioport in Michigan. And after the publication of this story, the FDA tested the lot numbers that I had specified in the article, and they found squalene in them. And there was a one-to-one correlation between the illness in troops and administration with lots of vaccine that the FDA proved contained squalene.
And again, squalene is a naturally occurring oil, but used here as a vehicle for the vaccine. So as a way to even out the vaccine, I sort of think of it like, I don't drink, but I'm always Goldschlager, right? Has the gold, little gold flecks in it, the alcohol, and that, so the, it's sort of swimming around in there in the gold, or like maybe a snow globe where you shake it up and the snow is sort of floating around in the inside the fluid of the snow globe. And that's what the squalene was intended to do, to suspend.
Yeah, you know, that's actually, that is a very good analogy. Because you know what happens with a snow globe, right? If you don't shake it up,
it eventually settles.
Everything is settled on the bottom of the globe.
Right.
The point of adding the oil or creating an oily suspension, an oil and water suspension, as they call it, is to make sure that those little bits of snow would be evenly distributed in the globe.
Right.
So had they done something similar with a snow globe, then in theory, you'd see all those flecks floating around all the way through the globe, evenly distributed, instead of all settling down to the bottom.
Right. One shake. and it would stay permanently shook.
That's yes. That was the point. They wanted they wanted an even distribution of the vaccine's main ingredient all the way through the water column.
And that in itself might be enough to have created this Gulf War syndrome of vaccination A. We're talking with Gary Matsumoto. Let me ask you about another aspect of this. Is it's important to say that the anthrax threat was real and that we have evidence of what happens. And this is where I'll go back to the original stacking of the story in vaccine A. Talk about the what happened. What happens when there is an outbreak of anthrax and the communities that are affected by this, like the one that was in Russia?
Anthrax is fatal because of something called bacteremia. You get a saturation of the germ in your blood. You know, it reproduces so quickly that your body is basically saturated with the germ. Now, what anthrax does is it secretes a toxin. It secretes a bacterial poison. And when people die, they're dying of toxic shock. And that is the danger when you leave anthrax untreated. And when people who have actually been exposed to this stuff first start to develop symptoms, they just think it's a bad cold. They get severe headaches. They get fluid in their lungs. It's like a case of pneumonia. And unless they are treated with the right antibiotic, it will be fatal. And there was an outbreak of this of anthrax in 1979 in Russia that is believed, according to Western intelligence, to have killed at least 300 people. The official death toll is 66. But people were literally dropping dead in the streets. So this is the sort of thing that we wanted to avoid.
Right, but how do they get it? How did they get it? How did the anthrax? You got to explain how the anthrax breakout happened.
Well, in Sverdlovsk in 1979, which is a city, a closed military city in the Ural Mountains, in a two hour flight east of Moscow. There was an installation that was making dried anthrax powders. And some one of the workers there forgot to change a clogged filter. Well, he took the filter off because it was clogged, but he didn't replace it with a new one. So when the next production run commenced, all the particles were venting through a stack at this military base, which is almost near the center of the city. The particles weren't getting captured by a screen because they left the screen off. So these particles flew out into the air into the night, carried aloft and abroad by the wind, and people inhaled it. And they inhaled a severe enough dose to make them sick and then eventually kill them.
And it's just the way the math worked, that if you put enough spores out into the air that can be carried in the wind like that, then enough people will inhale them. Once they've inhaled it, are they then contagious?
No, anthrax is not like a virus where you sneeze on somebody or sneeze into your hand and shake their hand and get them sick. It's a bacteria, and you have to have a lethal dose in order to get sick. Somebody has to, it has to be gotten into your system somehow, but not by a handshake, not by a sneeze, not by a cough.
And yet the way the Army gets its anthrax to turn into vaccines is to have, laboratories or barns filled with diseased animals from which we draw fluid. Is that how it works? And then we take that anthrax and we turn it into a vaccine?
Well, we have we actually have cultures of anthrax cultures from around the globe that were at one point extracted from dead animals that had contracted the disease naturally. So we have a library of strains in certain labs around the country. And so when you want to make stocks of vaccine or stocks of the germ from which we make a vaccine, they just culture it up from one of the strains in our libraries.
Where did the animals come to? Didn't at one point, though, were there some like monkey virus got involved? I was trying to,
in anthrax, in both cases, we had a weapon in the 1950s and 1960s. We had an anthrax weapon here in the United States, and it was made from a strain called Volum, V-O-L-L-U-M, and that came from a dead cow. And the AIM strain, which became notorious in 2001 because that was the strain that was mailed in letters to the media in New York and to a couple of senators in Washington, that too came out of a dead cow. That one was a cow that died in Texas. So what you have is a germ hot enough to fell a big animal, like a steer. And if it can do that to an animal that weighs several thousand pounds, you can imagine what it would do to a human being that weighs between 150 and 200 pounds. Knock you flat and kill you.
Right. And these various strains, too, that was also another concern in making vaccine A, in that if you have couple of different strains out, don't you have to have a vaccine that responds to every one of those strains?
Yeah, that was another one of the concerns. In fact, that concern stemmed from the discovery of how lethal the AIM strain was. In 1980, the United States Army got a strain from a USDA laboratory in Ames, Iowa. And this strain, which actually originated from this dead cow in Texas, proved to be the very hottest strain in our inventory. And they ran experiments at Fort Detrick where they were inoculating guinea pigs with the licensed vaccine, the vaccine that requires six shots over 18 months, was licensed in 1970, and the Army injected guinea pigs with it, and every inoculated guinea pig exposed to the AIM strain died.
Right.
They're all wiped out. So there was concern in the 80s that are, you know, based on a strain in our own library, that the vaccine wouldn't work. And when we deployed troops to Saudi Arabia, and eventually Kuwait, we didn't know what strain the Iraqis had. In fact, there was some concern that they might have had a Russian strain that might have overwhelmed our vaccine.
Even though we sold to Saddam Hussein and the Iraqis just a few years before that, whatever they wanted when it came to biological weapons, we sold them anthrax.
Yeah, we gave them anthrax strains that we thought were not weapons grade, and we did not give them the AIM strain. They tried to get it, but we didn't give it to them.
But they weaponized what they had, and we know that now. So then what else do we know about other Army experiments on soldiers? I want to ask Gary Matsumoto, author of Vaccine A, about the cold and flu vaccines that have been attempted on troops in the past. And then again, how is this going to affect us all in the future? That's the main discussion of Vaccine A, the covert government experiment that's killing our soldiers and why GIs are only the first victims. Next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. Gary Matsumoto, author of Vaccine A. We'll talk about the future of these vaccines and just who else might be affected by them coming up on Coast to Coast, but also take a look back at some of the other things that the government has done, we believe. I take that back. We didn't have to believe it. We know these because many of these have been published in regular, you know, mainstream medical journals about the things they've attempted to do with vaccines and troops in the past that may also have backfired. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. So, Gary Matsumoto, let's start with the past before we move to the future. We're talking about Vaccine A, which very likely caused autoimmune reactions in soldiers. That we see what happens when this particular cocktail, the serum, which may have been very well intended, was administered before it was ready and given to hundreds of thousands of troops, and causing what may only be a number difficult to estimate outside of the Army because these details are kept so private. But before that was done, the Army was also using troops as kind of a, you know, a kind of a petri dish for the experimentation of vaccines against colds and flus. Talk about the colds in particular, because that was the first thing, is that if they could eliminate colds amongst troops, that would really improve, you know, sort of Army readiness, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. And, you know, again, the Department of Defense has grounds for being concerned about it, because, as I mentioned, the great flu pandemic, Spanish flu pandemic of 1918, the killer pandemic that wiped out over 25 million people, started at Fort Riley in Kansas. So the military is always concerned when it brings new recruits together from all over the country to boot camp that there's going to be an outbreak of flu. And, you know, God help us if it's swine flu, which happened in 1976, and we had a disastrous vaccine campaign in response to that, but that's another story. What the military has been doing for many decades now has been, they've been trying to develop an effective vaccine, not only against the flu, but against the common cold, which is caused by something called adenovirus or adenovirus. I'm not sure what the proper pronunciation is. Anyway, these vaccines are all experimental, and in order to create a more effective vaccine, the military has been adding a booster to it, and the booster was an oil. Not the same oil as squalene. They were using a mineral oil, and these boosters are called adjuvants. That's the technical term for them. It comes from the Latin word adjuvare, to help. And these boosters are added to vaccines that are considered too weak. They don't elicit a strong enough or quick enough immune response. So the boosters are supposed to make the vaccines effective. In order to get a better flu vaccine, the Army has, from through the 1960s to the 1970s, administered, in particular at United States Air Force bases, experimental flu vaccines. And you know what Ian was going to mention? You know, we had another big problem with an experimental vaccine in World War II. And I'm thinking about this because, you know, we're about to observe the 65th anniversary of VJ Day. And in 1942, there was great concern that the Imperial Japanese Army was going to attempt to use biological weapons against us. And in particular, there was some concern that the Japanese were going to attempt to hit our troops with yellow fever. That's because somebody believed to be a Japanese agent in New York tried to get a yellow fever sample from a physician at a hospital on the Upper East Side. So we rushed into production an experimental yellow fever vaccine. And what happened was 300,000 troops out there on the West Coast, California, Oregon, and Washington, came down with hepatitis because the experimental vaccine was contaminated. So, you know, there's a downside to potential downside to trying to protect our troops with something that, that hasn't been tried and tested.
Right. I think that's the lesson, too, that makes us fearful about the future, because we hear about, you know, especially when the government gets all alarmist and, you know, what choice do they have in one sense, in that they, you know, they hear a hue and cry go up, and all of these are, you know, government is comprised of politicians. At least they are employed by politicians if they aren't one directly. And so everybody wants to look like they're on the ball at the government level. And so when you have all of these things like, you know, the swine flu or bird flu, and it just, you know, suddenly it seems like, you know, the government works overtime to try to get all these things so they can say that we're prepared. But yeah, at the same time, you know, if we look at some of the ways these preparations have been done in the past, they were hasty, and the you know, the cures were creating a kind of cruel to be kind scenario where many people were being adversely affected than would have been if nobody had gotten, you know, if nobody had been infected at all.
Yes. And, you know, and from a liability standpoint, you know, the problem with vaccines is you're administering them to a healthy population to prevent them from getting sick. Now, if you have an experimental medicine or a new medicine and you're giving it to, say, terminal cancer patients, the problems don't show up as much because it's hard to tease out how many people died, as you know, from the disease as opposed to the treatment. So yeah, you always, so if you're from a legal standpoint, if you're one of the big pharma companies producing these vaccines, it is a scary and risky proposition.
What do you see as a worst case scenario for what you've learned from your examinations into vaccine A?
Well, I think one of the greatest concerns is that there are certain elements in our public health system that have ignored inconvenient data. And the data in this particular case is 30 years worth of scientific papers published in peer-reviewed journals that show animals injected with this stuff develop the animal versions of multiple sclerosis and lupus and rheumatoid arthritis. And this is something that the public is not being told. And the reason why it's important for the public to know this is that the Public Health Service is trying to develop a whole range of vaccines for new diseases. And this became a front burner issue last year with the swine flu pandemic. Mm-hmm. There's a great panic over this. And two of the vaccine manufacturers, Novartis in Switzerland and GlaxoSmithKline in England, created an experimental swine flu vaccine that contained squalene. And the stocks were deployed in Europe, but not here. There was a hue and cry over the prospect of using this stuff here, even though we bought something like 80 million doses of the adjuvant alone to add to the swine flu vaccine. And there was a move afoot inside the Beltway to pass legislation to make administration with these experimental vaccines mandatory in the event of a killer outbreak. So had we had a number of deaths from swine flu last year, you might have well have been forced to roll up your sleeves and take the shot, irrespective of what's in it.
Mm. Again, we're talking with Gary Matsumoto, author of Vaccine A. The anthrax spores themselves, as you mentioned before, that the Ames strain of anthrax is what was used at during 9/11 in those famous attacks.
Yes.
Senator Daschle, I can't remember who the other senator was.
Senator Patrick Leahy.
Oh, thank you. And then, you know, to members of the media, and somebody did in fact die from exposure to the anthrax. The letter, the famous letter, said, you cannot stop us. We have this anthrax. You die now. Are you afraid? Death to America, death to Israel. Allah is great. The government inferred that that was a fake letter, that it was not actually written by somebody who was Muslim, but somebody who was taking advantage of the 9/11 attacks to sort of piggyback onto that. But what do we know about the Ames strain? I know this is slightly outside of your the course of the book, but that Ames strain of anthrax, how many people have it? I mean, how did it, you know, it ended up in the letter, and as you point out, the letter, the number one suspect, according to the FBI, was this guy Ivins, who actually did work on this this vaccine project in a way. But what, like, how many people have Ames anthrax?
Well, I'm not sure that anyone was able to determine that with any degree of certainty, because prior to the anthrax letter attacks in 9/11, scientists were cooperating with each other. They were very collegial, and they were swapping these strains like kids swap baseball cards. So if somebody requested a sample of the strain, say in England, we sent it to them, and the British had it. Now, at the time the attacks occurred, there was speculation that the strain was all over the place. And in fact, there is no evidence to support that. We knew as early as 1980, I mean, almost as soon as the strain arrived at Fort Detrick in 1980, it was determined that this was the hottest strain in our inventory. And scientists who were working at Fort Detrick at the time have told me that had the Army chosen to go back into the bioweapons business, Ames strain would have been our weapon. So the strain wasn't distributed that widely. We know that it went to Dugway Proving Ground in Utah. We sent samples to Porton Down, the British equivalent of Fort Detrick in England. The strain was sent to the University of New Mexico. I'm not exactly sure why there. It went to Battelle Memorial Institute in West Jefferson, Ohio. And it went to the Canadians. They have a facility like Dugway Proving Ground called the Defense Research Establishment in Suffield, Alberta. So, you know, we really know the hot strain, the strain that hadn't been doctored so that it wouldn't infect some people, you can do that. You can take out the genetic components that would infect somebody with the disease. And we sent denatured copies of the Ames strain to some labs, and only a few labs got the high-octane stuff.
Yeah, the hot strain.
The hot stuff, you know, the stuff that will kill you. So, in fact, the evidence that we have suggests that there is fairly limited distribution of the hot version of the Ames strain.
I was preparing for the show tonight. I was just kind of Googling around a little bit about anthrax, and I came across this story from 2005 about the U.S. Medical Research Laboratories, one a detached building in Arlington and the other in Falls Church, Virginia, where there was a presence of anthrax detected independently by two government laboratories. And I thought that's so fascinating because, you know, as you talk about, this is so you know, this stuff is so virulent. I guess that wouldn't be the right word because it's not a virus. But I mean, this stuff is so potent that.
Okay, yeah, actually, Ian, virulent is the right word.
Is it?
It is
okay.
The right word, yeah.
Okay. So that if this stuff is so deadly in that sense, that you would think, gosh, how did it end up like in a mail room? How does it end up anywhere other than in these, you know, Andromeda strain like laboratories where everybody's got to be in double, you know, suited environments? You know what I mean?
Yeah. You know, that's one of the enduring controversies from 911. And that is, was this germ weaponized or not? And
that was in the envelopes?
Yeah.
Oh, so we don't even know if it was weaponized anthrax.
Well, the FBI has stated and stated after the fact, starting in 2006, that the anthrax was not weaponized. Now, I think it's important to understand that when you're talking about an anthrax weapon, the germ, anthrax, is not the weapon. If you compare it, this bioweapon, to, say, a conventional weapon like a handgun, anthrax is analogous to the bullets. It's the ammunition. The weapon, the gun, is the aerosol. And the aerosol, we're talking about the powder that you must create out of the spores. Now, think about this, Ian. You know, a box of Tide, ordinary laundry soap?
Right.
Pours out like water, right?
Okay.
That's engineered. If you have, let's say, a basin full of soapy water and you just let it evaporate, what do you get? You get scum just, you know, around the basin. It's or little cakes of soap. You don't get a refined powder, and you don't get something that will flow like water, like Tide does when you open up the box and pour it into your washing machine.
Okay.
Now, the same thing with a bioweapon. You know, if you grow anthrax spores, it's in a soup. It's like a bacterial soup. It's made out of chemicals, and it's a slurry full of spores. And then you have to dry that. And if you just dry it, like, say, with freeze-dry it, which is one of the conventional ways of drying these spores in order to turn them into a weapon, you get, you know, little anthrax pellets, like anthrax BBs. So what do you have to do? You have to create a powder that is refined enough to float in the air. And what was sent to the U.S. Senate in particular was, it was of extraordinary quality because it didn't just flow like water. It floated like a gas. When somebody ripped open the envelope, the spores flew out, and they almost immediately dispersed. There was a little puff, and then they were gone. And they were gone because the individual particles were repelling each other, and they distributed throughout the room and all over the building. Now, creating something like that is a very sophisticated engineering trick. That, however, is something that the FBI doesn't want to talk about. The conventional wisdom is, well, this is no professionals did it. That it was, almost an amateur job. But they don't explain how the amateurs did it.
How the amateurs achieved a level of expertise that actually did deliver the anthrax the way it was supposed to be delivered, if it was an amateur.
And killed 5 Americans and sickened 17 others in the process.
Yeah. Vaccine A, this is the book from Gary Matsumoto. It's an investigative piece. It's great. It's very interesting from the very beginning when we talk about what happened in Russia with the outbreak of anthrax and why the government has every reason to be afraid of anthrax, but is it handling that fear in a proper response? The covert government's experiment that's killing our own soldiers, and why GIs are only the first victims. Vaccine A, Gary Matsumoto takes your calls next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.